Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on, and we thank you for listening. Before we start today's program and the introduction, I have a special message to the fans of Focus on Females. Our health and medical education programs, including this radio clinic, is financially sponsored by the not-for-profit 501c3 Focus on Females Education Foundation. In this difficult economic time, our donations are way down. Presently, we do not have the funds to continue this radio show past the summer. We made this announcement last week, and we did get sufficient donations to be able to fund another month or so of the show. But now we're facing the problem to go past the summer. If the show or the annual Focus on Females Healthcare Symposium has made a difference to you, or if you are comforted in knowing that you can turn to us as a live, ready, reliable resource every Sunday, then now is the time to show your appreciation. Please send a donation to the Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679. That's P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679. And we thank you for your support. Today, we are tackling what turns out to be a very common problem that women have much more so than men, although it can happen with males as well, and that's pelvic organ prolapse. And we'll get into that, what that means. That's with our guest expert today, Dr. Stuart Hart of the USF College of Medicine in Tampa, Florida. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with over 1,000 women during each of our last two events, with a combined 7,500 hours of education during those two symposiums, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through the immediate impact of direct with the expert health education. And before we begin our show and my formal introduction of Dr. Hart, I would like to make one announcement in regard to a previous show. And in the Tampa Tribune this past week, on July the 12th, was an article on mosquitoes with viruses on the rise, analysis shows. That's the title of the talk of the piece there in the Tampa Trib. And it goes into discussing mosquito-borne illnesses such as West Nile virus. And I want to share with each of our listeners here and remind you that we had a show on this very topic, and you can use it. You can go back to the website and review it in more detail, this topic. It was on May the 30th with Dr. Sam from the Hillsborough County Health Department and USF, the College of Medicine. That was May 30th. And if you're not comfortable, if you're not experienced with our website, you can go to focusonfemales.com. On the lower left side of that homepage is a link to the radio healthcare clinic page. You scroll down and you select the year 2010. We began this in 2008. And then so you scroll or you position your cursor over 2010, left-click that, and it'll give you the library of shows and the podcasts for each show in that year. Scroll down, and again, it's May the 30th. You can pull up that podcast and learn all about these mosquito-borne viruses and the illnesses that they can cause and what to do about this. Now, for today's show, Dr. Stuart Hart is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology in the Division of Urogynecology and Pelvic Reconstructive Surgery at the University of South Florida College of Medicine. He completed medical school at the University of Maryland, completed residency in OBGYN at Emory University, and a pelvic surgery fellowship at Northside Hospital in Atlantic, Georgia. Served as a clinical assistant professor of gynecology and obstetrics at Emory University from 2003 to 2006 prior to joining the faculty at USF. Dr. Hart is board certified in obstetrics gynecology and is a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the American College of Surgeons. He is certified in laparoscopic surgery by the Accreditation Council for Gynecologic Endoscopy. He is co-director of the University of South Florida Center for the Advancement of Minimally Invasive Pelvic Surgery. Dr. Hart's main research interests include image-based research utilizing 2D, 3D, and 4D pelvic ultrasound and MRI imaging. And by the way, any of the listeners interested in a research interest of his or what 4D pelvic ultrasound is, feel free to call in and ask the question. We may not normally would get to it in the course of this particular show, but do feel free to call in and ask questions that may pertain to his research interest. And MRI imaging, his interests include that as well, as well as medical simulation education and training and development of innovative medical devices and products. He holds a faculty appointment in the Department of Industrial and Management Systems at the University of South Florida College of Engineering and serves as a mentor to engineering students interested in developing medical products. He also founded the Medical Engineering Research, Innovation, and Technology Group, which is a collaborative research group of physicians and engineers that meet weekly to develop and commercialize innovative medical devices and products. He is also very involved in developing educational and surgical training courses for practicing physicians and has been the course director for multiple national and regional physician training programs. So, Stuart, with that introduction, it's great to have you here.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Maskin. I appreciate the invitation to be here.
So let's talk about pelvic floor, pelvic organ prolapse, pelvic floor weakness. This is not something I think that even many physicians who are not in the specialties of GYN, gynecology, or urology may be aware of, let alone the general public. What is pelvic floor weakness, and what is pelvic organ prolapse?
Well, pelvic organ prolapse, or what has been termed general prolapse, is really the descent of one or more of the pelvic structures. And we typically think of the pelvic structures as the bladder, the uterus, the vagina. Even the small bowel can work its way down into the pelvic area. And it's when these organs descend from their normal anatomic position within the pelvis and the abdomen into the vagina and sometimes through the vaginal opening. This is often described by patients as a lump or a bulge protruding through the vagina that can be very bothersome. And in essence, pelvic organ prolapse is a hernia of the vagina or a hernia of the pelvic floor.
Let me interrupt for a second, I can. But how common is this? How common? And should I go back further than that? How common, or I should say, is a weakness of, or does it imply, if there is some descent of pelvic organs, does that imply an intrinsic weakness of that of the floor of that pelvis in that patient?
Well, most pelvic organ prolapse is due to some type of weakness or some type of herniation. And in answer to your question about how common it is, it's extremely common in this country. If you look at the statistics, about 200,000 surgeries are performed annually in the United States for pelvic organ prolapse. And if you look at a woman's lifetime risk that they will need some type of surgery for prolapse incontinence, it's about 11% lifetime risk of needing a surgical operation. Other studies show that there's about a 3-8% prevalence of symptomatic prolapse. So not women who just have prolapse, but women who have symptoms of prolapse.
But wouldn't it be the case, I would think, that there's a tremendous amount of cases that are undetected?
Oh, absolutely. And the question comes down to is, what stage of prolapse is it important to detect? There's many women who are have prolapse and it's undetected. There was actually a recent study that showed that 50% of women presenting for an annual exam, whether it be a pap smear exam or just a well women's exam, actually had stage 2 prolapse. But the question comes down to, is it symptomatic? If it's not symptomatic, we typically take an observational approach.
And that's something I think that we'll get into in the course of the show, is that perhaps some symptoms that a patient may be experiencing may be due to prolapse, but yet they may not be aware of it. And maybe, perhaps maybe it's constipation, maybe it could be other things. We'll get into that and discuss it. And maybe taking some over-the-counter remedy, which is not quite working well, when actually the problem may be a prolapsed organ. So this is it sounds like a common problem. And so we discussed what is organ prolapse, the descent of the organ, and you mentioned from front to back, I guess you can look at it, right? Bladder.
Exactly. The easiest way, and this is how I describe it to my patients, in looking at pelvic anatomy is very complex. And so it's very difficult for most patients to understand the actual anatomy. But the best way to look at the anatomy of the pelvis, especially when you're dealing with prolapse or you're dealing with incontinence, is really to think of a bowl in your kitchen. Think of a mixing bowl. And that's probably one of the easiest ways to describe what is happening. If you think of a mixing bowl and think of the entire bowl as filled with muscle, and that's your pelvic floor muscle, what's called the levator ani muscle. Within that bottom part of the pelvic floor where the muscles are, there's three openings. In the front, there's the urethra tube, and that allows you to pee. That's the tube that comes from the bladder and allows a woman to pee. Now, right in front of that urethra tube is this bone that everyone can feel if you feel deep down the pelvis called the pubic symphysis. So right below the pubic symphysis is that urethra tube. In the middle of the pelvic floor, the middle of that kind of mixing bowl, is the vaginal opening, and on the backside is the rectum. And so the pelvic floor is a very complex interaction between the muscles and the nerves and the organs that are deep within the pelvis.
And may I suggest that that another analogy may be that of a trampoline, meaning that it's kind of a weak, it's not really a strong floor, is it? It's also kind of a weak, and things can kind of fit through it or prolapse.
Well, it's kind of both. It's mm-hmm. It is strong, and we want it to be strong because we want the organs to stay up in place. But at the same time, it's designed to be flexible. The goal of a uterus is reproduction. And during reproduction, a baby's head is coming down, and you want the vaginal area to distend and open. So you want it to be very flexible. So it's really a well-designed system that allows reproduction at the same time, holding up the organs in place.
Now, is it the act of childbirth which further weakens the pelvic floor, or I guess another way to ask the question is, those women that do not have kids or have not had kids, do they also develop progressive weakness of the floor of the pelvis and prolapse of organs?
They can. It's not as common as women who've had one or multiple vaginal deliveries or even pregnancies in general. But we do see women who have never been pregnant who both have incontinence and they also have prolapse. So it's something that is prevalent out there. And if they have symptoms, they may desire an evaluation for that.
Do they tend to get not as severe prolapse of organs? Or?
Yeah, we typically see these patients don't develop a severe prolapse, but there really runs a whole gamut mm-hmm. of symptoms and anatomic findings. I have seen women who have never been pregnant who do have fairly significant prolapse. And if you look at the risk factors for pelvic organ prolapse, pregnancy is one risk factor. There's multiple risk factors. It's really a multifactorial disease and or condition. And so that is just one out of multiple conditions that may be occurring that contribute to pelvic organ prolapse.
And so let's run through some of these risk factors. Would obesity be another?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the modifiable risk factors, obesity and smoking are the two most common modifiable risk factors. Obesity has clearly been linked to pelvic organ prolapse. In fact, a woman who has a body mass index greater than 30 which essentially puts that woman in the obese category, confers approximately a 40 to 75% increased risk of prolapse. Smoking, the same. Smoking may affect patients in different ways and may contribute to prolapse in different ways. Surely, smoking has been widely demonstrated to cause pulmonary disorders and issues, and COPD, chronic cough, has also been linked to pelvic organ prolapse. So smoking and obesity, those are simple lifestyle modifications that patients can work on that make really a significant impact, not only on the symptoms of pelvic organ prolapse, but also the symptoms of urinary incontinence.
Excellent. At this time, I'm going to take just a quick second here to share our phone numbers to call in with your questions. Here in Hillsborough County, it's 289-1860. That's 289-1860. Everywhere outside of Hillsborough County, it's toll-free 877-969-8600. 877-969-8600. And one more question at this point. Let's talk about some of the symptoms of pelvic organ prolapse.
There are a variety of symptoms, and women typically experience symptoms related to the type and severity of prolapse that they're experiencing. When you're defining pelvic organ prolapse, for many years we've used these definitions that have been out there in terms of how we diagnose it. And some women describe, and some patients describe, a cystocele, which has been which is basically a term to describe descent of the bladder. Some patients describe a rectocele, which is a term that has been thrown out there to describe descent to the rectum. There's also uterovaginal prolapse. But if you look at the symptoms of prolapse, they correlate to a degree with the symptoms a patient experiences. And symptoms really break down to several different categories. Women can have urinary symptoms, bowel symptoms. They can have sexual dysfunction type symptoms. When you look at the urinary symptoms, many patients describe urinary urgency and frequency and urinary incontinence.
So let's stop right there. So urinary urgency. Let's define some of these for our listeners.
Okay, urinary urgency. The easiest way to think about urgency is to think back to those gotta go commercials. You just have to go. You have this compelling desire that you have to void and you have to get to a bathroom. Whereas frequency, normal urinary frequency is about 6 to 8 times a day. So over 8 times a day is considered increased urinary frequency.
Okay. And are there other urinary symptoms that a woman may confront from this? These are symptoms that can come about from bladder prolapse.
Exactly. Okay. It can come about from any type of prolapse, but you see it quite often in patients with bladder prolapse.
So that's an interesting point, though. So you're saying that a rectocele or a prolapse of the rectum or vagina can actually cause some irritation to the bladder and therefore cause the bladder or the patient to get these symptoms of urinary frequency and urgency.
If you look at the pelvis, it's a very complex mechanism and a complex anatomic way that the design was created. So it's amazing that you can have prolapse in other areas but also cause symptoms in areas that may not be affected. And it has to do with the nerve innervation to the pelvis and the function. If you look at the pelvis, it's actually a very small area where there's you got the urinary system, you got the GI system, the bowel system, and then you got the reproductive system. So they're all kind of crammed into the small space in the pelvis. And if you disrupt, and there's actually studies that show that if you disrupt one organ through a neurologic mediation up in the spinal canal and up in the brain, it can affect other organs.
Excellent. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back with more with Stuart Hart from USF College of Medicine as we talk about pelvic organ prolapse on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Be right back.
There is a bank that's been in your community since 1942. They don't have free checking, and you never have to sit in their drive-thru line. And they don't have money. They have something that's far more valuable. It's the type of asset that comes from people and it gets passed on to other people. What kind of bank, you say? A community blood bank. The Community Blood Bank. Florida Blood Services, a nonprofit healthcare provider that provides for the lives of thousands of patients in every Tampa Bay area hospital. Okay, so they're not a bank, but they depend on you if you're the giving type. And right now, there's an urgent need for O negative and O positive blood, for accident victims, for cancer patients, for life. So if you're the giving type and you have O negative or O positive blood, consider investing in Tampa Bay's Community Blood Bank, Florida Blood Services. For a donor center nearest you, call us at 1-800-68-BLOOD. That's 1-800-68-BLOOD. Or log on to fbsblood.org.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
For the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. He has written a best-selling, award-winning book, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome, published by Yale University Press. Dr. Maskin manages dry eye disorders using, when needed, innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has successfully managed difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He has been selected a Best Doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2010. And as an America's Top Ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America, we hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please visit drmaskin.com. And if you have not found relief for your painful red, dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back to Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Today we're talking about a very common disorder, pelvic organ prolapse, and that is something seen with a weak pelvic floor, frequently occurs with women as they age. What is the earliest age you've seen a prolapsed organ through a weak floor, pelvic floor?
Well, we've seen it in women as early as their early 20s.
Okay.
One of the risk factors is chronic frequent heavy lifting, and I have seen it in patients. I've seen it in some military patients who are constantly lifting heavy equipment, and patients who are involved in jobs where they're on a day-to-day lifting a large amount of boxes and things like that.
Mm-hmm. How about bodybuilders?
Bodybuilders. But it's funny. I have actually not seen too many cases of early prolapse in bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's they're performing Kegel exercises or probably pelvic floor muscle exercises. I don't know. There's You've seen in the literature they've published on women paratroopers developing prolapse at an early age, but I've not really seen it in bodybuilders.
And again, as we just came back from break, this is Dr. Stuart Hart with me today from USF College of Medicine. He is a urogynecologist and focuses on the pelvic floor dysfunction and pelvic organ prolapse. Also within risk factors is like chronic hemorrhoids and chronic constipation. Would you say fall in that category of risk factor?
Oh, absolutely. Patients who chronically strain in general at increased risk, anytime you strain, you're increasing your intra-abdominal pressure. And if you're standing or erect, that if you look at physics, the pressure is going to go down. It's going to affect the pelvic floor. It's any type of chronic straining. And talking about young patients with risk factors, patients will often tell us that they've been straining during defecation since they've been a child. Mm. And those patients can develop prolapse at an earlier age.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We were talking about symptoms before the break, and you started talking about urinary symptoms. Urinary symptoms including urgency and frequency, and you made quite an illuminating point of how symptoms of bladder or symptoms affecting the urinary system may be secondary or derived from prolapse of a different organ system, for example, the uterus or reproductive system or the intestinal system with the rectocele, for example. And you mentioned how it could exert its influence through the neurologic system, which I thought was quite fascinating. So you can't really, if someone has a symptom of one particular organ system, for example, bladder and urinary incontinence, you have to obviously keep an open mind as to where the actual symptom is coming from. It could be anywhere in that entire pelvic floor.
Oh, absolutely. And it's both a neurologic mediated effect, but it's also a mechanical effect. If you have prolapse on one organ, it can impinge on the other organs and cause symptoms.
Let's move on to other symptoms like the reproductive system. What kind of symptoms do women report to you when they have a prolapse of the reproductive system?
Well, some patients report painful intercourse. They have pain during intercourse. Others report a decreased libido, and there is patients report embarrassment. If you have a vaginal bulge, they're worried that their partners may see the vaginal bulge. There's a fear of engaging in intercourse, and this does adversely affect sexual functioning.
How frequent is it that the vaginal bulge or prolapse is not visible externally, and the woman doesn't understand why it's painful?
Well, in early stage prolapse, it may not be visible. It may only be visible during a pelvic examination. In stage one prolapse, the bulge is really limited to within the vagina. And many of these patients are fairly asymptomatic. But in patients with stage two, the bulge can come down to the opening of the vagina, but may not be recognized by the patient unless they're have symptoms. And usually it's recognized during an examination.
Okay. Okay, so pain, decreased libido with the vaginal prolapse, and now how does that differ, say, from a uterine prolapse as far as symptoms involved?
Well, uterine prolapse can actually give many of the same symptoms, and oftentimes patients don't have one prolapse. Often they have several different prolapse. They may have something called an anterior vaginal wall prolapse or a cystocele that's coming down in conjunction with a uterovaginal prolapse, or they may have a rectocele with an enterocele, which is small bowel coming down towards the top of the vagina. So oftentimes when you have pelvic floor disorders or you have these herniations in the pelvic floor, it affects the pelvic floor in multiple locations.
Okay. So the point, if I understand, then the organ doesn't necessarily have to drop straight down. It could also move anteriorly. For example, the bowel moving anteriorly into pushing against the vaginal wall.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So things can go up and down as well as sideways, is what you were saying.
Exactly. But over time, there's a general tendency for the bulge to pass the hymenal ring and to be visible by the patient.
And also we talked about a bowel. As far as the symptoms come from that, constipation, diarrhea, could that be a chronic problem as well?
Not as much diarrhea, but patients will complain of significant difficulty having a bowel movement or pain with defecation. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, patients with more severe rectocele type symptoms, or there's a bulge from the rectum into the vagina, need to splint in order to have a bowel movement. And splinting is when they take their finger and they put pressure between the vagina and the rectum and push upward, or they take their finger and kind of splint the back vaginal wall in order for the bowels to empty. What happens is, in a significant rectocele, the stool gets trapped within this hernia sac within the vagina, and they're not able to effectively empty. So they need to strain or splint in order to have a bowel movement.
And this, I'm going to guess, this is something that sometimes patients figure out for themselves.
Oh, absolutely. The large majority of patients figure this out for themselves. They typically may have mild symptoms initially, and over time the symptoms worsen, and then they seek out medical advice.
So I imagine that it's causing some kind of aching or discomfort. They put the finger there, they find out that it helps relieve like an impacted bowel or at least constipation, and then they continue to do that.
Exactly.
They may not understand what they're doing, but they find that it provides relief.
Exactly. Women with a rectocele type prolapse, they just don't feel like they can empty their bowels all the way, and oftentimes they have a bowel movement and they have to go back and have a bowel movement several times more throughout the day in order to completely empty. These patients also complain of pelvic pressure, discomfort, and even back pain.
Lower back pain. And can it change if this, can this prolapse or anterior prolapse, or can it cause a change in the shape of the stool? By changing the lumen, the size of the intestinal canal.
Well, it doesn't change as much the shape of the stool. That's going to be more of a function of the anal sphincter in allowing the stool to come out. In patients with other types of bowel disorders.
But the size of the stool.
Exactly, where they have an enlarged bowel cavity, it may alter the stools.
Okay. All right, we're going to come back in a moment, and when we do come back, we're going to talk about some of the therapies, both non-surgical and surgical options, that can be offered to patients to help them with these disorders. Be right back with more. Before we go, again, the phone number to call with questions, 289-1860, 289-1860. Elsewhere outside of Hillsborough County, toll-free, 877-969-8600. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Chris Gould, and as a member of the National Religious Broadcasters, I have a question for you today. Are you praying for your local, state, and national leaders? Today, we all can agree that the United States of America faces challenges that seem overwhelming. But the ultimate solutions are not found in money, diplomacy, media campaigns, or political effort. As 2 Chronicles 7:14 reminds us, real change in our nation will only take place when God's people humble themselves and pray. When we recognize our need for God, repent of our own sin, and then ask God to have mercy on our families, our community, and on us. Repentance and change does not begin in Washington, D.C., but in the hearts and minds of God's people, both individually and in the church. Right now, Christians around the nation are taking part in 40 days of prayer. Join us and let revival begin with us, you and me.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit FocusOnFemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health.
in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back to Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. This is, I can tell you, a very educational show for me today. On pelvic organ prolapse, learning a lot with guest expert Dr. Stuart Hart, who is a urogynecologist at the University of South Florida College of Medicine. And we've talked about some of the symptoms of pelvic organ prolapse, which can include urinary symptoms like urgency and frequency, which can include reproductive or sexual symptoms like pain, decreased libido, embarrassment, as well as symptoms affecting the bowels, including constipation, the need for splinting or using a finger to help with passage of stool, as well as low back pain and other symptoms as well. And we'd like to move into, and as also actually we talked about risk factors, including pregnancy, obesity, smoking, chronic obstructive lung disease, chronic constipation, frequent heavy and lifting as some of the risk factors involved. I'd like to move on and to kinds of treatment options. Now, let's begin with the non-surgical treatments, Stuart.
Well, treatment options really come down to what the patient's preference is and how bothered they are by the symptoms, how symptomatic they are. Non-surgical treatments, or what we term conservative treatments, are very useful in patients who have mild or prolapse, patients who are elderly or frail, patients who desire fertility. They may desire to have children in the future, or they just don't want surgery. And there's several main conservative therapy options. One is simple observation. If the prolapse is very mild, they could simply observe the prolapse and return to their physician's office if the prolapse worsens. One that we spend quite a bit of time talking to our patients about is lifestyle modifications. Even if they just observe the prolapse, it is so important to work on weight loss, to work on their diet, to work on reducing exacerbating symptoms such as smoking, chronic cough, heavy lifting, and we also touched on constipation earlier, but increase the amount of fiber in their diet, their fluid intake, to try to decrease constipation, which is a risk factor for mm-hmm. not only prolapse initially, but also for recurrence of prolapse if they were to have any type of surgical intervention.
Okay. Now, the surgical treatment options, how does one, and maybe you might want to kind of correlate this with the stages of prolapse, I imagine, and for that matter, diagnosis of the specific areas of pelvic organ prolapse, how, if you could kind of put that all together.
Well, talking about stages of prolapse, stage one, as we described earlier, is really a bulge that's limited to within the vagina. So the patient may have some symptoms but not necessarily notice the prolapse. So typically we don't offer surgical therapy for stage one prolapse. The prolapse typically becomes more symptomatic by stage two, but definitely by stage three, where the bulge is actually outside the opening of the vagina. And stage four is a complete prolapse where essentially the vagina is maximally protruded outside the vagina. So in cases of stage three and stage four, surgical therapy is clearly indicated for treatment. Stage two, it really comes down, even stage three comes down to the patient's symptoms.
And the workup of pelvic organ prolapse, aside from the history and examination, are there any imaging studies or other studies that need to be performed for complete evaluation?
You know, once again, I think it depends on the patient's symptoms. For many years, examinations, a proper examination for prolapse was really the mainstay in diagnosis and then treatment of prolapse. It's very important when we diagnose prolapse. A patient goes to a physician and she thinks she may have prolapse, not only have an adequate exam, but have that exam while the patient is bearing down. We really want to assess the maximal prolapse that a patient deals with, because during the day, a patient's out and about. You know, a woman may be exercising, she may be laughing, sneezing, coughing, and we really want to assess the maximal degree of prolapse. So it's very important during examination to assess this, and during examination to also assess how well they empty their bladder. A patient may have a procedure called a post-void residual, where they measure how well the bladder empties. Depending on the findings of the examination, there are some imaging studies that do help us in the diagnosis and may guide us into therapy. One of them is this 4D ultrasound that we spoke about, the 2D, 3D, 4D ultrasound. It's a newer technique. It's a technique that doesn't expose patients to radiation, and it basically uses a simple ultrasound probe that we've used for many years to take a deeper look inside and really assess what is happening. Dynamic MRI is also a terrific modality to image the pelvic floor and really kind of gives us a global picture of what is happening when the patient is straining. Older studies such as a defocography are still being done, but are quickly being replaced by some of the newer studies such as an MRI. And then sometimes we may do a urodynamic study, or basically I tell my patients it's a bladder stress test. It really examines the function of the bladder to see why they may have urinary symptoms in preparation for possible therapy.
So if there's a introcele or the bowel prolapsing into the vagina, or the bladder coming into the vagina, what have you, these tests can give you that information that it may be out of reach of the examination.
Exactly. Both the 4D ultrasound of the pelvic floor as well as the dynamic MRI are allowing us to look into the anatomy and see anatomic changes that we really couldn't see before. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more and more patients coming back who've had surgery in the past. And if you look at the statistics, about one-third of all the surgical procedures done in this country for prolapse are for recurrence of prolapse.
Interesting.
And so these patients are coming back more frequently. They've had one or more surgeries, and their anatomy is quite complex. So these imaging modalities really allow us to get a much better sense as to what's happening and really allows us to tailor their therapy, especially if they do desire surgical intervention, really tailor it to their exact anatomic defects.
Okay. And how long has that been available, these more advanced studies?
The ultrasound's been around for many years, but more recently it's been used in this manner to diagnose pelvic floor. Dynamic MRI it really has been investigational up until the last several years, but now we use it much more commonly in clinical practice.
Does that use contrast dye, the dynamic MRI?
Typically not. Typically we use a rectal contrast. We're not giving IV contrast. Mm-hmm. The rectal contrast really helps define the rectal area, especially in patients who present with a long history of chronic constipation. Really allows us to see what is happening in what we call the posterior compartment, or the area where rectocele may occur, and really kind of tailor therapy.
If someone has an iodine sensitivity or allergy, would that be a problem with the contrast used in that case?
No, not at all. The contrast that we use is a gel contrast in the rectum, very different than if you go in for an MRI and need an IV contrast. Mm-hmm. We have gotten away from using IV contrast for the dynamic MRI of the pelvic floor.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, now this diagnostic, the 4D ultrasound, is that done in the office?
We do it right in the office.
And
it's a fairly quick procedure. Typically takes about 20 minutes. We use a typical abdominal probe, a probe that a woman may have had placed on their abdomen when they were pregnant to look at the baby. It's placed outside the vagina. You want the patient to be able to bear down and cause that prolapse to come out, because we want to mm-hmm. visualize it with the ultrasound.
Okay. And the dynamic MRI, I imagine, is an imaging center?
It's in an imaging center.
Okay. Very good. Okay, so let's say we have the information now, and the patient is symptomatic and is interested in having some kind of surgery. And let's say they're stage four, it's completely outside the vaginal opening. How do you advise patients what kind of surgery they need? What should they expect? Post-op recovery, the nature of the surgery itself.
Well, when a patient elects for surgical treatment of prolapse, there's several factors that we look at. Number one, what are the symptoms? How severe are the symptoms? Is it affecting their ability to empty their bladder, or their bowels? How is it affecting their quality of life? We also look, of course, at the severity of the prolapse, but also the general health of the patient. If a patient is elderly or frail, has multiple medical problems, we may not want to put them through an extensive surgical procedure. And it also comes down to the patient preference. And there's really two main types of surgical intervention that we offer our patients with prolapse. Number one is reconstructive surgery, and the other is obliterative surgery. Reconstructive surgery is when we're reconstructing the normal anatomy of the pelvic floor. versus obliterative type surgery is really useful for an elderly patient with multiple medical problems who does not desire sexual functioning in the future and may have this stage 4 prolapse that you spoke about. In those patients, an obliterative procedure where we essentially close the opening of the vagina and it elevates the organs back into their normal position is really an ideal procedure because it's much less invasive, much less time in the hospital, and less risk compared to a reconstructive surgery.
Okay, so, and then for that, I imagine for that case, the obliterative, when you close the opening, even though the organs are in there and they provide a weight over time, what's the risk of the wound reopening again?
It can, and we see cases of it, but it's much less common than recurrence with a traditional reconstructive pelvic surgery.
Do you put any kind of material inside that opening to help retard the pressure on the wound itself, directly on the wound itself? Like a graft of some sort?
We sometimes do. Within pelvic reconstructive surgery, over the last several years, there has been a tendency to use graft materials. If you look historically, the general surgeons have been using graft materials for many years to correct hernias, usually hernias in the anterior abdominal wall. So the theory was if patients have a herniation of the pelvic floor and the general surgeons have had such good success using synthetic materials to make up for the deficiency of the tissue holding everything in place, why not use it within the pelvic floor? So mesh materials are used, and they're used quite frequently within pelvic reconstructive surgery to kind of reinforce the native tissues and achieve that improved function and anatomic outcomes. But with that, there come problems. There's risks of using mesh. And any patient that is to undergo a pelvic organ prolapse surgery, you have to determine the risks and benefits. Is it worth using mesh? Is it going to achieve the long-term goals? And that's a discussion that a physician would sit down with the patient and really kind of go over the risks and benefits of using mesh or trying to repair the prolapse using the patient's native tissue.
And so let's go talk about the normal state of the art as far as resuspending, would you say, the organs? What's the way to describe that?
I think it really depends on the type of procedure being done. Quite often, let's say a patient has uterovaginal prolapse. They may undergo some type of hysterectomy procedure with elevation of some part of the pelvic floor or vagina, really depending on the type of prolapse that they have.
How would you elevate it?
There's several ways to elevate it. If you're dealing with uterovaginal prolapse, and uterovaginal prolapse is descent of the top part of the vagina, so you would have to elevate the top part of the vagina, and there's several ways. One is to resuspend the top of the vagina to these ligaments called the uterosacral ligaments. These are natural ligaments that have really held the pelvic organs in place throughout most of a woman's life, and in cases of uterovaginal prolapse, there may be tears or attenuation or stretching of those uterosacral ligaments. So sometimes you can suspend the top of the vagina back farther deeper into those uterosacral ligaments. Another procedure that is commonly performed is a sacrocolpopexy procedure, where you essentially suspend the top or the apex of the vagina using synthetic mesh. And this can be suspended up to the sacrum of the spine, which is a good fixation point. It's a permanent fixation point to minimize recurrence of the prolapse.
Hmm. Okay. So we're talking about suspension of the vagina upward. I imagine there may be a need to do some kind of hernia repair if there's prolapse or bulging from the rectum or from the bladder into the vagina?
Absolutely. It really depends, and I know we alluded to it earlier, that many of these patients don't have one defect. They have multiple defects. So part of the evaluation is to try to determine where these defects are and what procedure needs to be performed to adequately repair these defects. So it may require several surgical procedures to adequately repair these defects. Oftentimes it can be performed during one extensive surgery, but sometimes it does require other surgeries to adequately fix these defects or hernias.
And so this is performed under general anesthesia, I imagine?
Our surgeries are typically performed under general anesthesia.
And what kind of guidance can you give listeners as far as The sounds like a potentially lengthy surgery, depending upon how many defects there are and if the desire is to conquer all at one setting. But also, if you can comment on the postoperative recovery.
You know, the postoperative recovery really comes down to the surgical approach. And the surgical approach comes down to physician preference, physician training. So it really depends who you go to as a physician, what their training is, what their experience is, as to what approach you have for surgery. Some approaches and some surgical procedures are performed vaginally. Some are performed through larger abdominal incisions, and some are performed minimally invasive through a laparoscopic approach. Also, vaginal is considered a minimally invasive approach. So it really depends on the type of approach, and then patients recover at a different pace. There are some patients that recover very quickly, and others it's more of a lengthy recovery, and that has to do more with how the patient heals and genetics. So there's multiple factors to it. But in general, if the surgery is performed in a minimally invasive manner, the recovery tends to be quicker, better than a patient who may have a larger abdominal incision in order to fix the defects.
Okay, so say for a urovaginal prolapse, and let's say patients having a suspension or to elevate with their own natural ligaments, this is something that may, 6 weeks or more of recovery?
Typically, from any surgical procedure, whether it's a minimally invasive procedure or a larger abdominal procedure, we usually tell our patients approximately a six-week recovery. Mm-hmm. It tends to be a little bit less in the majority of the minimally invasive surgery-type patients. But once again, it really comes down to the patient. But I think 6 to 8 weeks is a good time frame for the patient to recover. And anytime you have a pelvic reconstructive type procedure, you are at a risk of recurrence of prolapse. So it is so important postoperatively to not perform heavy-duty activities, heavy lifting, quit smoking, lose weight, and then also control any underlying constipation that may be there, because that is a risk for future recurrence of prolapse.
You mentioned that in one study, at least, a third of the cases that are being performed or have been performed were those of recurrent cases, recurrent prolapse.
Exactly. And some studies show up to a 40% recurrence rate.
Do you see that changing with the new techniques going forward into the future?
I might say
the new diagnostic technique with 4D ultrasound and dynamic MRI, perhaps getting a more complete picture of the complete pathology.
You know, we hope. We don't have that long-term data. We hope that as we advance our surgical techniques, as we come up with better materials to fix these hernias, we can reduce the recurrence risk. But we're not there yet, and there's still a lot of studies that need to be done to see if even our newer techniques within the last 10 years have made a substantial impact in reducing recurrence risk.
Okay, I'm going to ask you two things. One, if you give your clinic phone number if patients want more information. And number two, a quick take-home message about pelvic organ prolapse. We have 30 seconds.
Yes, the phone number for USF, and you can find the phone number on the web, is 813-259-8500. As a conclusion, pelvic organ prolapse is a very common condition, and it's a condition that can cause many symptoms for many of our patients. If you're symptomatic, it's always good to seek medical advice. Find out what the options are available. There's many conservative therapies that are available, and there's many good surgical therapies. So I encourage any listeners to follow up with their physicians, really explore the options thoroughly, and come up with the option that best suits your quality of life and makes the most sense for you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Dr. Stuart Hart, USF Urogynecology. Next Sunday, the topic is dry eye and meibomian gland disease. Of course, this is a topic which is of great interest to me. We'll be discussing the latest technology, the latest developments, very exciting developments in the treatment of dry eye, and specifically meibomian gland dysfunction, which is arguably the most common cause of dry eye in the world. In the meantime, this is Dr. Steve Maskin wishing each and every one of you a happy and healthy week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio.